Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kate.
Hi.
And Nisha.
Hey there.
And this week, we are getting together to talk about the stories that like we revisit and retell and rewrite and why we do that, and specifically in the context of Wicked, because that comes out, I think, the Friday after this episode airs. So seemed like a good time to have that conversation. But before we get into that, what have y'all been enjoying this week?
I can start because I want to say that while Chad Powers fell apart and ruined my boy Glenn Powell for me, because he should have done better and he should have known better than to leave us with that ending, The Running Man is good. It is fun. It is. If you go in expecting Arnold Schwarzenegger and you think that Arnold Schwarzenegger is the source material, mm-hmm. you will not have a good time. If you go in understanding that this was a story that Stephen King wrote and that is actually the source material, then you understand it a lot more as to why he's coming in as Ben Richards and it is nothing like Arnold's. It is not good enough, I think, to surpass Arnold Schwarzenegger's Running Man from 87, but it is a really fun time at the movies, even with like the messy ending, and you get to see like really angry Glenn Powell, which
I assume is hot Glenn Powell.
I'm here for it. Yeah, you see his butt, he yells at people. He talks about how bad the government is and how it needs to be shut down and we need to kill executives. So, like, I'm here for it. It's the Glenn Powell we need right now.
I mean, I'm hearing Glenn Powell butts and anti-capitalism, and I feel like that is just a Venn diagram of your
exactly,
interests.
Exactly. That's where we are. That's what we're doing. I think other than that, the other thing I do want to highlight is that But Why Though are on the judging panel for the Indie Game Awards, which will be taking place December 18th. So thank you to the 6-1 Indie crew who produced that award show inviting us on. It has been amazing to see how much the Indie Game Awards have grown and also their specific focus on the diversity of the global video games. And I don't just mean diversity here in the U.S. I mean the global landscape of games. Mm-hmm. They are partnering with women-led games, Southeast Asian-led games. They are partnering with Black Voices in Gaming. They are partnering with the South African Games Collective and the Latin American Game Showcase. All of them have special awards to highlight indie games from those regions. And that, to me, is really exciting. And I think that we tend to think of the U.S. especially as this hub of gaming, or maybe only Japan. And we don't think about the work that so many developers are putting into games. So I just wanted to shout that out. We are going to be judging. We have reviews for quite a bit of the games, but not all of them. So, yeah, girl is playing a lot of indie games right now. But it is
really
exciting.
To be able to just sit down and,
it really is. And it's beautiful. And I think that if you there at home or in your car listening to this podcast are like, yo, what indie games should I be playing? Well, you can go to butwhytheough.net and you can check out the full list of nominees, which we've gone ahead and published. And if you want to go to the Indie Game Awards and support them, they are at indiegameawards.gg. You can also see the full list of games there and bookmark the streaming channels because it will be streaming on 6-1 Indie, IGN, and GameSpot. This was not an ad, although I realized my voice went into the ad section, but it I needed people to hear me nice and clearly so they tune into the Indie Game Awards.
Well, it's not an ad, but they are an organization that we've worked with that we know that we like. So it's a friend ad. It's a plug.
Exactly. They're fantastic. It's great. Play more indies. Go there, play the nominees. You're going to end up with a great time. I believe me, more than Claire Obscure and Silk Song came out this year.
Which actually, I'll talk about my thing. One, I beat Silk Song, like true ending, hard ending. Took a lot of time on my part, took a lot of frustration. You can ask my wife about that. So we don't need to rehash like the difficulty conversation, but I will say this is one of the few games where I found myself kind of doing the calculus of like, where is the difficulty coming from in a really analytical way? Because there were times where I was like, the difficulty is just that I'm not reacting fast enough. And then there were other times where I'm like, the difficulty is you didn't account for like, you know, because the AI is just pulling the attacks or whatever. And it's like, oh, you didn't account for like literally unblockable strings or, you know, things that are going to put people in a position where there's like mandatory damage or unavoidable combos and stuff. And I don't think that that's like a knock against the game necessarily, but it is one of those things where I was like, I got through it. I can say that it's beatable, but also there were times where there was difficulty that felt like it was an oversight, not intentional. Like you only at maximum, you have 10 health, and most bosses, or sorry, every boss I think does 2 hits of damage per hit. So at the end of the game, you can survive 5 hits before you're dead. Or the 5th hit is what kills you. But then, there's also like they actually toned it down. It used to be that environmental damage did 2 points of damage. So if you bump into a spike, you lose a 5th of your health. And little things like that where I was like, okay, this is like they heard the fan feedback that that was overkill and they toned it down, and I appreciate. But yeah, there were just, it was a lot of analysis that I don't normally do when playing like a Souls-like. And then the other very quick thing is, have you guys started watching Pluribus on Apple TV?
I have not, but it deeply intrigues me.
So I watched the first episode last night and I'm like, I gotta watch all of this now. Do you know the premise of it?
Not really. I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Do you care if I spoil the premise of it? Okay. So spoilers, if you're listening, you don't want to hear it, skip ahead 30 seconds. The first episode centers on, there's some scientists, and then there's another side story about this, romantic-y author. And when the stories converge, it's that there is basically a worldwide incident that turns humanity into a hive mind, except for this woman. And at the end of the episode, they reveal 11 other people. So it's like literally everyone in the world shares a brain, is in you. Like there's a scene where she's talking to someone and says, well, who am I talking to? And they're like, oh, this body is so-and-so. Just was nearby. I was what we needed. So I'm here talking to you, but you're talking to everyone.
Ooh.
And it's like, oh, so this is going to be like, I assume a commentary on social media, on the internet, on how, you know, I can post something and tag you guys in it on Blue Sky. I'm still talking to everyone. So I think it's going to be interesting. I'm very intrigued with where they're going to go with it and what they're doing with it. But yeah, it was just the way that it was all stitched together was really good. It looks like it's going to be a typical Apple TV 50-minute sci-fi drama, which, yeah. I mean, people are here for it. We have For All Mankind, we have Severance, we have Silo, we have Foundation. Like, it's, I feel like
sci-fi
Apple
is their best genre.
Yeah, I would say Apple has found what they do well, and it's this. It is sci-fi drama.
Yeah, isn't there the Murderbot one too?
Or is and Murderbot, that one was fun.
Yeah. So keep pumping that out. But no, I'm interested. I will definitely crank up my iPad so I can watch.
Yeah. But yeah, I think those finishing Silksong and then finding that show have been my highlights this week.
Nice. I guess for me, I'll go last. My highlights this week have been Frankenstein. I have watched that now.
I need to watch that.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And somebody made like a very interesting point. I don't want to spoil it for people, but like Frankenstein made me think, as somebody who does want to have kids one day, this should be required watching for people who want to be there one day, because watch it. But that between that, Absolute Batman, I've been reading that now. I'm finally catching up and actually reading something besides my manga. Mm-hmm. That's been really good. And then gaming wise, I finally got Dispatch, so I last night. So I'm gonna check that out because I'm tired of people spoiling the game. But it looks really fun and it looks different, and I like that as far as like a superhero video game.
Nice. With Absolute Batman, I want to say I haven't read it yet, but I just saw. Did they introduce Joker finally? Is what I was reading.
Yeah, I think I'm probably three in. Yeah, I think I've read. Okay. Volumes now, or however, whatever they're called from comics.
Oh, trades, yeah.
Yes, trades, thank you. Yeah, so I've read 3 of those now. You meet him, but then like there's like this other thing that keeps on popping up on social media is like, wait, is that him? Like, is he
looking? Oh, interesting.
Eldritch terror.
That's the one that I saw, was like this absolute nightmare creature, and I was like, interesting that they're going so weird with this series.
Yeah, it's if Darkseid really, because like for people, just again, not a big spoiler, but like essentially what happened is Darkseid remade the universe and he took away Bruce's wealth and took away his father. He still gets a mom, And he's basically an engineer, brilliant genius engineer, still becomes Batman, but his childhood friends are like Penguin, Harvey Dent, Dial. So like his whole life is drastically different, but like he still becomes Batman. So that's where I'm at right now, where I'm just realizing that like, oh wait, yeah, all your friends are your villains.
That's cool. I'll need to read that. Kate, you've seen the Absolute Batman design?
I have not.
Google it real quick. I just want to see your reaction to it, because it's a lot visually.
Yeah.
Wait, which one?
The slab of beef in a cowl.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I love this.
Yeah, just real thick. The bat thick logo boy, basically being a rectangle.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's
that thing on his chest goes into a battle axe, Kate.
That's amazing.
Pulls it off, it assembles into a battle axe, and yeah, it's a very brutal and graphic comic, but at the same time, you see like there is a very soft side to him too. So Kate, you're right, he is a good boy.
Is with it being an axe, is this a Batman who kills?
I mean, he damn near kills. I would say one part where like there's this supremacist group and he just goes off, like,
all right.
Snap.
So the Arkham model of like, I'm gonna break your arms and leave you in the snow unconscious, but I'm not gonna kill you.
Yeah, like I'm gonna plant bombs to cut off your course, and if some of you like are collateral damage, so be it.
Okay.
They make a point to like call out, no fatalities. Like he's stabbing with the
people really latched onto the whole Batman doesn't kill thing, and I'm like, you gave him an axe, Batman kills.
He's stabbing people, even if he is missing the vital organs. Like there's still that, and also Alfred is like this, I don't know if it's for MI6, but Alfred's like a hitman.
Okay.
That's
got to be from the Pennyworth show. I appreciate that DC is finally toying with Batman lore a little bit, but yeah, that's, I got to read it. I just got to read it.
I will say the one thing I do want to add from onto the what do you call it, to the Frankenstein, is remember when I brought it up after I first saw it, where I was like, this movie is very Latino. They've been doing a lot of press, and apparently telenovelas actually inspired the way that Oscar Isaac performed as Victor, and him and Guillermo del Toro only spoke in Spanish on set while directing and acting. That's how he received his feedback, which was super, super cool. So yes, the cycle of violence from Latino fathers to Latino son was not me overreading into it. It was intended. I think Guillermo del Toro said that it was a European story told in the most Latin way that he could. So I don't feel crazy.
No, that was great.
All right. Before we get into our main conversation, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Omith Randier on Blue Sky and Instagram. I'm still on Twitter. I post some work there. Instagram's primarily for all of my traveling, which maybe I'm done with this year. Maybe I'm not.
Nice.
You'll see, because my Laboo-boo will show you where I am.
Adorable. As for me, you can find me on all social media platforms at Nisha Plays. A lot of cosplay content, discussions, things of the like, or when I'm just have a goofy, nerdy thought that pops in my head, that content goes there.
All right. And you can find me on Blue Sky, most always Alex, where I don't post anything particularly intelligent, but I think hopefully you'll be entertained. And yeah, with that, let's get into it. This is, honestly, I almost wanted to rewrite this episode to be about Romeo and Juliet, because I was like, that's a good way to frame what we're talking about. Because I think that's genuinely one of the most retold stories. So I'm going to use that to frame sort of the scope of this. So they're straight up like just a remake where it's like, we filmed it. And then there are like reskins. I don't know if you're aware of, I think it was a 2011 movie called Romeo and Juliet. It's exactly what it sounds like. And then there's also a much more subtle one, which is Warm Bodies.
Yes.
Which is, I don't remember, I think the girl is just Jules and the guy is a zombie that they call R, but it's like, yeah, this is literally just Romeo and Juliet. And then you get like the real auteur type of stuff where it's like a specific vision, being like the example for this, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet from the 90s.
The best Tybalt in existence.
It's incredible. John Leguizamo does so good, but like the hyper stylized, the saturation, the cinematography, the costuming, replacing swords with guns, setting it in Venice, like, you know, or in Venice Beach, like all of it, just so many good choices and very stylized. And then you get into, and this is more where Wicked falls, you get into like second angle fiction. There's a book series called When You Were Mine, and it's Romeo and Juliet, but it's from Rosalind's perspective.
And so, and then even, was it Rosencrantz and Guildenstern?
Yeah, that's another one where it's like, well, what were these guys doing? Which actually, and then the other Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Lion King 1.5, which is literally, it's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead for children. And then you get like the fan fiction stuff. Like there's a musical called And Juliet. And the whole premise of this is that Anne Hathaway, not that one, has convinced William Shakespeare that he should rewrite the ending of Romeo and Juliet so that Juliet doesn't die. And then the musical is about, well, what might her life be if she didn't die? And it's like, it's fun. It's a good time. And it's, they make sure that Romeo is an absolute fuckboy in that musical and really highlight how terrible he is, because the play does allude to like, this isn't maybe the first time he's fallen in love with somebody in 2 days. Like he's, you know, not maybe not the best, but so that's kind of what we're talking about, is like these stories that we keep coming back to, specifically not talking about sequels or franchises or like hero's journey, but like this is a story that we just keep coming back to and molding and playing with. So again, why discuss it now? We got Wicked. So Wizard of Oz comes out in 1900. 2 years later, it's a musical. 37 years later, it's the movie that we know. There's a whole series of books written by the original author, and then more books written by other authors. And then in 1995, we get Wicked as a novel by Gregory Maguire, which have either of you read the book?
Yeah, I have. Okay.
I haven't read it. There's a whole series. I think there's 4 books at this point. Mm-hmm. And they're all along the same line of reinventing Oz and kind of telling a different, more thorough story. Because the original Wizard of Oz is a kid's book. It's pretty fleshed out as far as, you know, trying to give you an idea of like geography and culture and all this stuff. But like the specifics of the characters, the relationships are a bit more on the shallow side, I think is fair to say. It's, mm-hmm. again, it's for children. And then Wicked, like 2006, I think, turns into a musical. And then we get the 2020s two-part movie musical that's wrapping up this week. So it's kind of on that Romeo and Juliet trajectory, I think, of like, we told the story once and then we just couldn't leave it alone. And we keep coming back to it. And I guess the thought exercise I haven't put myself through is, why Wizard of Oz? Like, why is that a story that we're drawn to revisiting? I know that for me, I read the book as a child, and then, you know, when I was older, learned, oh, here's all the metaphor that people are reading into this. And, you know, I read it when I was 6 and I didn't know what the Great Depression was, or, well, I guess not the Great Depression, but, you know, the Industrial Revolution and all that. So I didn't read any of those metaphors into it. But I do wonder if it is, does it just lend itself to metaphorical, or to metaphor in general, and that's why we keep poking at it?
I think so. Like, I think, and like, I'll just add to the list, The Wiz. Like, that's,
oh, enough. yeah, that's another one where it's literally just Wizard of Oz, but it's like, we're doing a whole new thing with it.
We're doing a whole new thing different.
Oh, music. And then there's that Zoe Chanel one.
Oh, Tin Man.
Yeah. Like, there's so...
That one was insane.
Yeah.
That one is, what is it? It's like the Scarecrow is a former government advisor who had his brain removed, and the Tin Man is an ex-cop, and that's, they call them Tin Men because that's what their badges were. And mm-hmm. yeah, but I remember watching that on Sci-Fi Channel and being like, this is a really, really interesting attempt at reinventing Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many different attempts to it though. But I think, like, to answer your questions, like, I think it's because like it, Oz in and of itself is a very interesting place and premise. And when you add in, when it's not just black and white, like Dorothy comes there, gets trapped, like, you know, tries to find her way home. Mm-hmm. She's the hero of the story. But then it's like, when you start thinking about like, well, what made the Wicked Witch wicked? Like, why was she called wicked? Like, I think it's that.
Yeah.
Like, people are curious to see characters more fleshed out as we get older, at least it, I'll say for myself, as I get older, I'm like, you can't help but look at a character that you once saw and then think like, well, why did they become evil? And I think that's what like a lot of these like the producers, Hollywood themselves have probably thrown in on for people. Cause think of all those Disney villain movies, Cruella, Maleficent. Like, I think it's them saying like, well, there's a story behind them too. We can make up and cash in on, but I think, and maybe that's, I'm not trying to, you know, make it sound heartless, but like, I think maybe there's that part of it, but then there's like opportunity where Wicked kind of fleshes out a character and explores, is Wicked thrust upon a person or are they born wicked? And I think that's the interesting part of like, then you can get into the different themes of like propaganda, politics, other, like all the themes. Cause I that's
totally
the thing about the McGuire books is that it really digs into the political landscape of Oz. Not that I ever thought about what was the political landscape of Oz when I was watching this movie with my grandmother, but you know, at, as a teenager, when you read Wicked, you're like, oh, this stuff was dark and the wizard is evil.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because in the original, it's very much the wizard is a dude who showed up there and kind of conned his way into power. And that was like, you know, a little done out of fear, a little done out of I'm going to make the best of this situation. But I think you're right that Wicked is, I think Wicked's one of the more identifiable early examples of the sympathetic villain trope, where it's, we got to go back and figure out why they're like this. We have to give them a backstory that we all understand and can agree with. And I think you're right that to a degree, there's like a capitalism component of why Disney does that. If I remember right, Gregory Maguire, when he wrote it, was like, oh yeah, I was broke. And it was kind of just a Hail Mary of like, this is the last thing I'm going to try to do before I get a normal desk job. And then it, you know, it blew up. And now I think he doesn't have a desk job, I assume.
It's funny. I never put it together till now that I think the success on Broadway of Wicked is why we like consistently get, I personally don't like villain stories like this. Like I want my villains evil and I don't mind atonement, but I don't need, like, I hated that Cruella movie that they're like, here, like the lady who like kills dogs incessantly.
The Cruella one is the one where I was like, how do you spin I want to murder puppies to make a coat and be like, no, but it's sympathetic.
That's, I'm like, damn, I got this man to blame for this shit.
And I agree, Kate. I think like the retcon and villain stories isn't always necessary, or like, it's not done well when it's done, like, when it's executed.
It's just, it's too much.
Yeah. Because it's like, does every villain need like, oh, I wasn't really the villain, it's because of this. I'm like, okay, how do you explain Scar killing his brother?
Oh, yeah.
Like, and then they go ahead and they make Mufasa. So we can do that.
I mean, I just watched Back to the Future and it was like, oh, right. Biff just is a sociopath and a rapist. Like that's right. That's Biff. That's the villain. Like it was so
sometimes
much simpler.
It is okay if a villain is a villain. And I don't like the door that Wicked cracked open. I understand what it's doing, which I think fundamentally is not what Disney, like the movies that Disney the villains that Disney chooses to mess with, I don't
think
the accurate ones. But but that being said, I think for me, when it comes to Wizard of Oz, there is something inherent about the talking about the way those in power pull the wool over somebody's eyes and you just kind of go with it and stay with it because that's what you have expected to do. And that for me has always been what the Wizard of Oz has shown, is that like you're not forced into any role. And it's funny that like, I think within the proper Wizard of Oz, that's not really given towards the Wicked Witch, which I think is why like Wicked does succeed and kind of does have a really rightful place in this type of retelling. But I think like overall, it's always been hard for me because like I'm not entirely intrigued by Wizard of Oz like when I was younger, and I found myself trying to get into all these different iterations, and I just like, I don't want to say I can't, but I just like, it's boring to me.
Yeah.
And I think it's because we've seen it so many times. But I think that there is, whether it's boring to me or not, I think that there is a large section that like this is hitting people with no matter mm-hmm. what. And I think that that is entirely interesting for it as like a title or as something that inspires everything after it.
Because I agree. Like, I will say this, like, I was not a Wizard of Oz fan. It was just a movie that came on around Christmas and my grandmother loved to watch it. So it's just like, I, by proxy, ended up watching it. And then of course, like the Wiz in my family is like something people love to watch. So also couldn't get into it. It wasn't until I read Wicked the book and then I found out it was a musical that I got interested into, like, I guess the world of Oz. But like, when I think about people like, oh, what do you like about the Wizard of Oz? I'm like, I like Wicked. Specifically, the McGuire books. I like that. But I like the movies because they're enjoyable. But it's, I don't know, like it's well done. And like agreeing with you, what you said, Kate, is just like it works and it fits in there because I think the McGuire did the work of trying to really flesh out these characters instead of making them the one dimensional.
Yeah.
Icon that people know from The Wizard of Oz. Because a lot of people who love The Wizard of Oz may not have read or heard of or known that Wicked was a book until they're like hearing about Wicked the musical.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take it a step further. I think a lot of people who like The Wizard of Oz don't know that The Wizard of Oz was a book. I think that the movie has eclipsed the book pretty significantly. And so For me, I read the book when I was six, loved the movie when I was a kid, read the book, like immediately locked in on like, oh, here's all the changes that the movie made and like very aware of like the alterations to like lore and everything, which also I'm in this weird spot where I enjoy Wicked as a musical. I think it's a great soundtrack. It's very fun. As a fan of The Wizard of Oz, it bugs me to no end because there are parts of it that rewrite established lore and not like established in obscure books. It rewrites things that were established in the original Wizard of Oz. But then I have to remind myself, oh, public consciousness is the movie and the movie doesn't touch any of this. Like there's a whole chapter of the book explaining where the winged monkeys come from. And it is not even sort of what Wicked says where Wicked says they came from. Which for me, I'm like, okay, yeah. Like you did do an interesting thing with it. It's just in my head. I'm like, it's not canon. Like this is Wicked is solidly done fan fiction for me. But that doesn't make it not good. If that makes sense, like doesn't make it not enjoyable. I was going to say this only just a quick tangent related. I was going to say something that I think is also fascinating as far as revisiting stories. The Wizard of Oz movie is a musical. And then The Wiz is also a musical with just completely new, you know, just like, hey, we're going to do our own thing with this. And I think it's interesting that this story has so much allure that people are not just revisiting it, but like revisiting it from the same angle, but doing slightly different things with it and building out their own. I mean, The Wiz also has its own aesthetic to it. Like it doesn't follow all of the visual cues of the original movie. And it's just interesting to consider, like, I guess that's also a conversation about what's canon. Because to some degree, public consciousness determines canon more than authorship.
It does. Yeah. I think like one of the other things I think is interesting too is I think that as much as like Wicked is like a look at a piece, or I think fan fiction is a great way to describe it, and not like as a slight towards it. I think that there are really good additions to existing worlds that people built first as fan fiction, and they were able to build into something larger. And I appreciate that a whole bunch. I think for me, what really sticks out to me is less of the Wicked of it all, less like this, the Wizard of Oz of it all, and more about its ability to transition from book to film, or book to Broadway play, a musical to film. And I think that even that trajectory, even if you're not looking at different stories and retelling different stories, the medium that you're putting it in is retelling that story on its own, because each medium has its own value. Each medium has its own detriments as well. And I think for me, my favorite, like told through multiple mediums is The Outsiders. And I didn't realize this until I saw The Outsiders Broadway's Across America play, a musical.
I didn't know there was one.
Yeah, I didn't either. That shit made me cry like a baby. Oh my incredible. God. Yeah. My friend took me because her mother has season tickets. And so when she has openings, she'll offer. And I was super excited. I was like, well, I didn't know there was an Outsiders musical, but like I am a mark for anything Outsiders. And for me, the Outsiders growing up was a book that really hit me. And I think Oklahoma, and we've talked about this before, Oklahoma is the okay thing to talk about when you want to talk about rural America and also talk about the South without talking about the South. And The Outsiders, I think, was a really easy way for me to, like, having grown up poor, grown up around gangs, grown up with the very real possibility that I would be in a gang, as well as like my best friends who I lost to gangs. The Outsiders to us actually was one of like the most engaged conversation that our classroom had ever had on one of like the classics, because we all could see what was happening with the greasers and the socias and how we saw ourselves in it, especially in the context of a school that had a magnet program also in it. Like that delineation between the poor and the not was really sharp. And so when I watched the movie, I was like, oh, this is really, really cool. I like the movie, but there is something missing from it. And then when I watched the play, watching the stage production, watching the musical, that was when, and I liked the movie well enough, but the musical brought to it elements that I think were missing, because I think musical theater gives you the ability to take those internal monologues and build them out larger because of what happens to your voice when you sing and you show emotion in it. I also think because they casted Dallas, who is like the extremely tragic member of that entire piece, they cast him as a Black actor, and it had much more weight, because there's a lot of ostracization that Dallas has, one, because he's been to juvie, two, because he has had no home. And then you add in the other elements of racism in that time period, it makes you look at it differently. And then the greasers are all, the majority of the greasers cast outside of Pony Boy and his brothers are people of color. And so there's like this added element that comes in casting that was explicit with the Outsiders musical when it was produced, that I think made it, I understood why. Like sitting in that theater in intermission was the first time that I actually understood why I loved the Outsiders so much, because of what that musical did, because of how it was cast, and because of what like limiting the scope to one stage does when you are telling a story. And I think like with Wicked, I think that there is, because I actually do love the Wicked musical. I don't like the movie, but I do like the Wicked musical, but it's because I think that there is a level of restraint you need to go through on stage to move things quickly, move from scene to scene, and it imbues it with more creativity. And I think bringing a book to that is really cool. Anyway, that was my contribution of iterations of a work. But it's what I've been thinking about when you brought up the idea of this episode, because like technically, while The Outsiders was not like, there wasn't an angle that was taken to it, the mere fact of adapting it into a new medium and the cast you choose for it, that highlights different emotion that story brings out. And like I like implore you all to like go onto YouTube and try to see if you can find like Stay Gold Pony Boy like sung. It is heart-wrenching. The performer, I'm gonna look up his name, Tyler Jordan Wesley is who plays Dallas Winston, and he is, sorry Matt Dillon, he's better.
He's the better Dallas. Yeah. Well, and so I think that's the thing, is there's, so one of the easiest reasons to revisit something is that the themes are still resonating and that it's still a relevant story. When was the original book written? Do you know?
It was during the Great Depression, I thought.
Okay. So for you to read that as a teenager and be like, oh yeah, I get it, is like.
So like the movie came out in 1983 from Francis Ford Coppola, and then 67. So no, it did not come out, and it was about that era.
Yeah, so. But still, you know, resonating so many years later. And so it's like, that's why we revisit. But then I think you pointed out something really good with the casting, that you can retell the story as it was written and make these little changes that ultimately highlight different themes, bring other, you know, other aspects of it to the front. It's very much like you're just throwing an EQ on top of it and you're like, let's boost this a little bit, let's pull this back a little bit, let's find the other things in here that are meaningful to people. Or, you know, I mean, I think remaking it, this is maybe a dumb reason to remake something, but I think it is kind of true. Sometimes kids are just going to need to see actors they recognize in a thing. And so being like, oh, watch this movie from the like 80s, 90s that was based on a book from the 60s about something in the Great Depression. And a lot of kids might bounce off of that because it's like, I don't know any of the eras you just said, but right. If you put actors I know in it, maybe I'll lock
it's
in.
More
maybe I'll pay attention.
Yeah.
That's such a good point, because my godbrother is reading The Outsiders right now for work, for class. And I was like, oh, he's going to love this. And it's just like, when I try to help him like comprehend certain things, I'm like, I have to pull in like characters that are things that he's familiar with. And I'm just like, to explain like the whole beef between the two gangs, or like to explain things, or like explaining to him that like, yeah, no, Ponyboy's friend did something wrong, but he did it to save his friend. And he's like, yeah, but he did something wrong. I'm like, yeah, but he did it to save his friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you have to like, there's nuance, there's complexity. You have to tease these things out.
If there was a mature rated Hulu or R-rated Hulu series about The Outsiders, I guarantee you those kids could eat it up faster.
Oh, yeah.
Like Euphoria, but Outsiders. Not saying that those two things, those never happen.
No, but it is dealing with adolescence. It, like, and that is, and I guess too, like, this is where we have like this larger, I'm actually like thinking about this when you say this, is I think like, I have never hated adaptations, because I think when it is like decades after a thing, you're able to pull in new audiences. But I completely agree that like, it is, if you had like Euphoria, like Outsiders, you would be in a situation where you have a higher reach of people hearing a story that they really should. And I do think like there is a reason that we do retell these stories, right? Like the reason we retell Romeo and Juliet nonstop. Yes, it's the romance, but it is the basis of teenage romance, to be honest, is thinking that everything is down the drain. Like most people tell that story as, yes, star-crossed lovers, but also don't be stupid and kill yourself because literally you don't know.
Honestly, the one Romeo and Juliet that I, maybe it exists, somebody tell me on Blue Sky if it does, I want to see somebody make it at, because there's a theory that Shakespeare wrote it intending it as a comedy, because it is ultimately two teenagers falling in love over the course of like a couple days, and so many people die as a result. And it's like, it's really absurd. I would love to see a comedy version of this where it's like from the parents' perspective, who are like, what the hell is going on?
What's happening?
Right. No, I actually would love to see that, because just them as teenagers and like the way that book is romanticized, and I was always that kid in the class, is just like, Romeo doesn't love her because he just said he loves somebody else. Like, what do you mean?
Yeah. But, like, he's clearly just kind of like shooting his shot everywhere.
Basically. But yeah, no, I think that would be hilarious to see it told as, if it was intended to be a comedy originally, I think it would be even better.
Right. Just really draw that out, really make it funny. And because then you get to this thing of, I think the interesting thing you could do with Romeo and Juliet is you want to validate the realness and the intensity of teenage feelings, while also highlighting that it is not actually the end of the world and people don't need to die over this. And like, I feel like you could actually make a really meaningful version of it where it's like, we're going to point out that it's silly, but we're also going to validate you because we all went through the same thing growing up. I think that that's like, that kind of is the, to me, the highlighting new themes or showing people something in a new light is like the main reason to revisit. And I do think to some degree, like going back to Oz, part of it is just that the concept is fun. The idea of this land that is isolated from the world by a desert that will kill you if you step foot in it. And it developed its own weird culture and everything. And there's magic and all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's fun. Like, that's cool to explore. I love that. Like, I get why people want to open that particular bin of action figures and play with it.
Yeah. No, I think it's, there's something to appreciate about it. I may not like deeply love it, but I think that there's a reason that we keep coming back to it. And I do think ultimately the way that the take that they've gone on things with it for me is that they've added more weight to it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think the fact that they have invested so much into developing the parts of the story that really are about how we other people and really do influence the way how we treat other people and how mm-hmm. like you can push some, like how you can have empathy for someone when you realize that they've been pushed to be the outsider. They haven't wanted to be, but they were pushed to it. And mm-hmm. I do think the way that Wicked has kind of gone out of its way to double down on those themes, I think mm-hmm. is really important for people to know nowadays, especially in the type of worlds that we're in right now. So as much as I don't like it, I think it serves a really, really valuable purpose. And I think mm-hmm. it repurposes a classic. And I think that if we're making adaptations of things, if we're adding on to things, telling some, like saying yes and with a classic is some mm-hmm. of the best things you can do. And that's what Wicked has done. And yeah. I know, like, reading your work on it, Nisha, honestly, Nisha did this really good deep dive into comparing the books and the films. And that was the first time I was like, oh, there's actually something more going on here. And that was when I actually started to have like a lot of respect for it, less of me just being like, I love Kristen Chenoweth, and more about me being like, oh yeah, no, this is trying to do something big with a property that we do all know. So if you all want to read that, you should, because it has like, genuinely, Nisha, you did a phenomenal job in showcasing why it's an important story, and why how the movies differ, yes, but ultimately what the takeaways should be mm-hmm. From them. So
yeah, I also a really just a personal anecdotal funny thing that has come from Wicked is Wicked has been how I have been teaching my niece and nephew. They are, I think, like 8 and 5 at this point, eight and five, but teaching them about canon, because they saw Wicked, they loved Wicked, and then they knew The Wizard of Oz was a book. And I was like, I have a copy of it, like, I'll bring it over and, you know, read some of it to you. And having to explain to them where they're like, oh, so when is Elphaba in this? And I'm like, her name's not Elphaba in this. And also, she is the villain. I need you to know that. And they're like, well, why is she a villain? She's good. And I'm like, she's not in this. Like, trying to, like, help them understand, like, these are characters you know, but it's a different story and it's a different, like, idea around them. But this has, I think, been their introduction to the idea of canon and, like, and iteration and, you know, telling stories different ways. I don't know that they've really seen that before. Or they haven't engaged it, I should say.
Well, I was going to say, like, I think it's actually kind of cool, too, because I think if anything, if you see something that is an extension on a work like this, it's almost inspirational to understand that you can find that same type of inspiration and build something yourself, too. Like, inspiration can yield something creative and different, which I think is important. Now, at the same time, too, like, I think I would be way more on board with retellings if we got, like, more Rosencrantz and Guildensterns, more Wickeds, more mm-hmm. things that take inspiration and explore the nooks and crannies. Like, I actually think, for me, the really good example of this was the Lord of the Rings War of the Rohirrim movie, because the mm-hmm. The what it's referencing is about 2 paragraphs, maybe, in the appendices, where we hear about the daughter and the war and the lore behind her dad when you see him in the big stomping like frozen hell beast that the orcs end up thinking he is. Mm-hmm. And they take that small cranny that was there in the appendices and build it into something that is completely unique. And I think that that's probably a good space to see where these types of retellings go. So thank you, Wicked. Something I never thought I'd say.
But I agree with you. Like, going back to what you said, like, if we're going to do retellings, please have a yes and with it. Because I think that's where Hollywood seems to think, like, oh, people just want things regurgitated to them and retold to them. I'm like, no, like, I need there to be, like, an added element. I need there to be, like, another reason. Like, if you, I think Anastasia is one where we have the movie, there's books. But, like, as far as, like, series and other things that haven't...
That was also a historical figure. So that one's a little different.
Right. But people have books, and then there's, like, musical, and then there's, like, cartoon movie. But it's just kind of, like, at this point, like, okay, like, if you guys are going to do this again, I need to know what else is there. Like, and I think people have done that through, like, you know, different iterations of looking at characters like Rasputin and things like that. But it's, like... If you're gonna do that, I'm not pitching this, but I'm saying, like, if somebody were to do that, then yeah, go ahead and retell the everything, but from Rasputin's point of view. Like, that's, I guess, like, that's my, I, like, that's where I'm at too, Kay, where I was like, if we're gonna do all these retellings, there needs to be, like, another angle or, like, an add to the story. Cause, like, I, as much as the canon is great, it's kind of like, yeah, or either flesh out the things that we know about the world and explain it a little bit more, and we're give it more nuance, because I think that's where I'm kind of fed up with retellings. We're like, yeah, I don't need this story told to me again, and I have no interest in seeing it unless it's gonna do something that hasn't been done before. Which, I mean, like, you know, like we talked about Frankenstein earlier, there's been so many Frankenstein movies. I think this one does a really great job of, again, doing what we're saying is just, like, it adds more to it, but it also does stick to some of the canon from the Mary Shelley book. And
so this Frankenstein is actually the closest we have ever gotten towards the actual Mary Shelley book, outside of, like, I think maybe Penny Dreadful was one of the closer looks at the creature, because the creature, like, Mary Shelley literally wrote that the creature was hot.
He specifically designed him to be hot. That was the whole point. Was he supposed to be a perfect man?
I love Shelley so much for that. But I think that's the thing. Like, it's close to the canon, but then it makes you think differently about those characters now. Like, we're like, we've seen Victor be a caring father to the creature in other iterations. We've seen the creature mourn for Victor if he's dead or whatever. Like, but this is one that, in my, like, for me, that's come close to the book, because in other iterations, Frankenstein's just, like, reduced to a monster.
Yep.
But like, you know, he's tragically not a monster. He's a gentle giant. So, yeah, I'm rambling now about Frankenstein.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I think that perspective is just a really powerful way to shift any story. I mean, like we talked about, you know, if you put Romeo and Juliet from the parents' perspective, it's insane. And I think Frankenstein is very much one where it's like, well, are we using a sympathetic lens for the creature, or are we using a fearful lens? And that really paints the story that you're going to tell and the lessons that you're going to walk away with. And I think that, yeah, you guys are hitting it on the head of, like, I get that sometimes we just retell a story to retell it. Sometimes we do it to maintain copyright. But ultimately, like, I'm less interested in a retelling and more interested in someone toying with a thing and trying to tease something new out of it. I mean, didn't we we just got a remake of War of the Roses, based on the book, but based on the movie, but titled The Roses, as if that was going to trick us into thinking it wasn't War of the Roses again.
Yes.
And not to say that there's anything wrong. I haven't seen The Roses. Not to say there's anything wrong with the story itself, but it's like, I don't know that we needed to remake that. I think perspective is just a really powerful way to shift that. I think it was either a Tumblr post or a tweet, but about how if you told The Parent Trap from the dog's perspective, it's a horror movie, because it is your owner comes home, but you know it's not your owner, but it looks like your owner and sounds like your owner. That's, and it's like, oh yeah, that's messed up. Like, and it really is. It's just, if we put the camera over here, now it's a different thing. And so, yeah, I think that, like, while I have a knee-jerk reaction against remakes, I think retellings where you're actually to put it in video game terms, I feel like there was a lot of conversation around this with was it Resident Evil 4 or just like the recent bunch of remakes and remasters where people are like, well, did you rebuild the game or did you slap an HD skin on it? Like it, like there's a big difference with what you're doing and whether or not you are correcting gameplay issues from the original, and are you, you know, fixing the puzzles that were too obtuse and making them a little bit more straightforward, you know? And I think it's the same with movies and books and TV of, are you just doing it with a new face or are you actually trying to find something new? And I should say, it doesn't always pay off. There have definitely been ones that try to explore something new and it's like, oh, this is bad. Like you made this bad. Somehow I'm now struggling to come up with an example, but I know that it's happened.
Yeah. I can't think of anyone that's bad, but I know one that I really recently liked is Epic. Like the indie musical for The Odyssey. It's not a stage play yet. They are in the works of trying to get it animated into a musical. But
that's cool.
Go on YouTube, you can watch it, and like basically artists from all over came together and they designed and like did snippets and they collaborated it all into like a 2-hour like film, like a concept film. So it pairs with each saga, and basically it's the Odyssey told from the perspective of Odysseus, you know, trying to make it back home. But it does add like something extra to it because it is a story of how Odysseus is determined to get back home. That's always been true. But then you add in other layers, like, you know, there's his friends, there's like and then there's like characters like Circe that are revisited, and like other elements of like, oh, what makes a man a monster? How does Odysseus go from being this heroic, chivalrous person who wants to get home with all his men to getting home just himself, and like the journey he goes to? But then it's also the layered story of him and his wife like loving each other through it all.
This is reminding me, isn't Oh Brother Where Art Thou the Odyssey?
Yes, it is.
It is.
So sometimes the retelling is just that the structure of the story is fun and we want to play with, and it's like we're not bringing anything necessarily new out, but we are having fun with the story.
Pretty much. That is true.
Well, it is also the thing too, is like, I'm surprised you didn't bring it up, Nisha, like Lore Olympus, like the retelling of Hades and Persephone consistently, no matter where we are. And like, I don't say that with like, I love them, I eat it up every single time.
Yeah.
But like, we go back to the Greek tragedy well all of the time. Like only thing that is like adapted more than fucking Shakespeare is any Greek tragedy. I'm not even gonna say Homer. Like, no, it is just any Greek tragedy.
Well, I was gonna say, you all know about Hadestown, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another great example where it's like, okay, we're gonna take a basic story of Greek mythology, we're going to like apply this, and here's what I don't know that this is actually like a secret sauce recipe, but I feel like my favorite Greek mythology retellings are where it's like, we're going to take a Greek myth story and then apply a completely mismatched music to it. So the original Hercules movie from Disney being like, oh, what if we just throw a bunch of gospel music in this? And I was like, hell yeah, this rules. This is so good. And then Hadestown having this like big band, Southern infused music to it, and it's like, oh yeah, this is not even sort of ancient Greece, but it works. Like, it something about that just seems to, at least for me, really work when people take Greek mythology and throw a nonsense skin on it. That's just like, oh yeah, this has nothing to do with the era, completely historically inaccurate, but it brings out something new.
Yeah.
Because I think like in the Hercules movie, that adding that music to it, that style to it, using the muses, it builds a level of hype around Hercules, and it really it kind of draws you into where the crowd is when they see him doing his thing, and when they get excited and you're like, yeah, like this is getting me also excited about this. And it's just a really effective technique, and I think that that's, you know, just a cool thing that people have figured out works.
Yeah.
But yeah, good point that Greek mythology is like, that's number two for things that we just keep going back to.
Pretty much. Bread and butter.
But yeah, I think that kind of does it for me this week. I don't know if you guys have any additional thoughts or if you want to wrap it up.
No, just that I feel like I need to give the damn Wicked book an actual chance, and I'll listen to it on audio because of this stupid conversation.
Just read the first two books. Like, I promise. Son of, like, Wicked and then Son of a Witch.
Okay.
You can stop there. Like, if you want to read the other two after that, that's on you, but, like...
I've heard the other two are not as good.
They're not
audiobooks. Audiobooks, here I come.
Yeah, just those two opened your mind to like the world of Wicked in a way that's very different.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, yeah, so that does it for us this week. If you want more, we do have it. But Why Though is a whole website. It's where you can go and read Nisha's piece on Wicked and deep diving the books. We're also on Blue Sky at butwhythough.net. You can subscribe to our newsletter, which is free, or you can donate, which is money, by going to butwhythough.net/support. Either of those actions goes towards keeping the site running. It helps us keep the lights on, pay our writers, do the things that we do, make the content you enjoy. So if you enjoyed this episode, please consider doing one of those two things. Again, that's butwhythough.net/support. Kate, Nisha, thank you for joining me. This was a lot of fun. And now I'm like, do I need to go listen to Wicked? I at least the musical again. I've listened to it for a long time, but also the book, because it sounds like there's maybe more to it than I even realized.
The more people I can convert to One Piece or reading the Wicked books, my work here is done.
Every time I look at One Piece, there's like another 100 chapters and I get intimidated. Because I consider reading it probably once a year, and then I'm just like, oh no, there's more. But yeah, I'm also looking at that one. But yeah, thank you guys for joining me. This was great. And thank you at home for listening. We'll see you next time.